Okay, so last time we looked at how a computer develops molecular orbitals that go all over the molecule and have interesting shapes analogous to atomic orbitals. So we had this plum pudding view that showed how important kinetic energy is in determining electron distribution when we looked at the far out contour and saw the molecule as a united atom. But if you want to understand how bonds work, you have to go further in to a higher contour level like this one, which looks, as we said before, like atoms that have some sort of weak bonding between them. Okay, so the plum pudding molecular orbitals that computers generate go over the whole molecule, but we can understand chemistry better if we look at bonds, at local electron distributions, rather than things that go all over the molecule. In particular, pairwise, linear combinations of atomic orbitals as molecular orbitals. Now, this is a linear combination of atomic orbitals. A linear combination is how a mathematical sophisticate says you add two things together, okay? But you can add them in different ratios, okay? So a linear combination of atomic orbitals is just a sum, and it's like hybridization. We already saw adding orbitals together, right, to change electron distribution, but they were orbitals on the same atom, right? These are orbitals on two different atoms, but otherwise it's just the same. It's still an orbital. What does that mean? It's a one-electron wave function. What's it a function of? Position of just one electron. So this isn't, you add two things together, but they're the same electron, right, that they're a function of. And why do you have 1 over the square root of 2 in there? Can anybody see why you might have that? Yeah, Chris? It's normalization, right? Because if you just took one of those orbitals and squared it and summed over all space, right, you'd get 1. And if you have 2 of them, then you'd get 2. But if you want it to sum to 1, you have to have 1 over the square root of 2, and you square it and you get a half, and then it looks just fine. So why is this form a sensible form? Suppose we looked at the simplest molecule, H2+, so just one electron. There's only one orbital that we have to worry about. But suppose the two nuclei are very, very, very far apart from one another, and we want to know on time average, a very long time average, what does the electron distribution look like? Any guesses? So we have, suppose we just had an atom here. You know what that electron distribution looks like. Say the 1s orbital on here, you square it, you get that electron distribution. But suppose now you had another proton over here. So that on a very, very long time, what would you see? If for the average electron distribution, would you still see that? You'd see that only half the time, right? You'd see this half the time, right? So what would you expect on long time average? If they're so far apart, they don't really influence one another. Amy? Oh, no, no. Why wouldn't the electron be in the middle? No, by average, I don't mean its average position. The average position, if it's half the time here and half the time here, would indeed be in the middle. That's the average position. But I want the average electron distribution. If half the time it's here and half the time it's here, then on average, it's both places, but half the density. Do you see what I mean? Okay. Okay, so that's what it ought to look like. Now, how can we write a wave function that does that? So we want the probability, the function of the position of one electron, to half the time look like AO squared, AO of A squared, the atomic orbital of A, and half the time to look like the atomic orbital of B. So it'll be half of one distribution plus half of the other distribution. See what I'm saying? Okay, now how do we write a function whose square has that property? It's quite obvious. You just take the square root, right? Bingo. So we got it. Matt, you look skeptical. Why? Pardon me, you didn't say. Aha! So you've studied this kind of thing, and you know you're going to have that in there too. You know, it would be 2 times the cross term, except we have that 1 over the square root of 2, which will then cancel the 2 when we square. Okay, so is this an error? Is this an error when we assume that this should be the wave function? Well, let's think about it a little bit. How big, if this is an error, how big is the error? These are numbers, right? They're functions of space, right? AO of A has a big number here, and then it gets smaller and smaller and smaller exponentially, right? AOB has a big number here, and then it's smaller and smaller and smaller as you get away from there. How about the product of A and B? Would it have a big value here? Because B is very small. Would it have a big value here? No, because this one's small. Would it have a big value in the middle? Why? Both of them are small. Right? So, we're talking about great distance here. So, in fact, that's negligible, that thing. Right? At great distance. Right? But suppose they get close enough together that they have this that those values are not negligible, right? Then we've got a problem, right? Well, maybe not. Let's look at that. So if we approximate a molecular orbital as the sum of 2 atomic orbitals that way, that looks very good near the nuclei, right? Because near nucleus A, B's are small, so it looks like A. I mean, it's a little small. You know, it's 1 over the square root of 2 times as big as A. But it has exactly the right properties for an electron that's near A. It's got the right curvature, right, for that potential energy, and so on. So it really looks very good near A. And similarly, near B, it looks like B. That's very good. So at least it has those properties that are good. Now, if you square it to find the electron density, you get an electron density that half the time looks like A squared, half the time looks like B squared, but then you've got this 2AB term, right? But suppose we were to take that total electron density and subtract out what the atoms would look like, okay? So subtract out 1 half A squared plus B squared, the thing we really thought we wanted at great distance. Suppose we subtract that out, then we find that the difference is this. It's A times B. This is a byproduct of squaring, right? That's how we got this term here, was when we did the squaring, right? So this is a completely different instance of multiplying. We talked about multiplying before in order to get a 2-electron wave function, maybe. That is, write orbitals and multiply them together to get a molecular 2-electron wave function. That's not what we're doing here. This is just, all these things are 1-electron wave function, right? But when we squared, we got that A times B term, right? That's where that came up. Okay, but what is that doing to things? Now, notice incidentally that this is, if we sum this over all space, it's going to be too big. Because it was, this sums to 1 over all space, that sums to 1 over all space. We have that factor of half, right? But we also have that, right? So it's too big. So in truth, we're going to have to make those just a little bit less than 1 so that it will sum to 1 over all space. Okay, the probability will be 1. Okay, but notice what that does. It shifts this 1 half is bigger than that less than a half. So when you subtract this from this, you get some negative density where A and B were. So you shift electrons from where the atoms were, and you put it down here to the region where they overlap, where A and B have big values, simultaneous values. Did you ever see anything like that before? Pardon me? Right, it's exactly what we did in X-ray in order to see the bonds. Right, you take what it would be if you had atoms, this, subtract that out from the total, and you get this little bit, which is bonds. Okay, so that overlap, that A times B term, actually is what creates bonding. So instead of being a mistake, it's really the essence of bonding. Okay, so you mix localized wave functions in a double minimum potential. This is exactly the slide we saw before. So if they're far apart, it looks like one or the other, and you can write the wave function by adding the wave functions, and you square them, and it's half the time one place and half the other. But if you bring them close together, then you get something that looks like that, and that stabilizes the particle, right? And the electron density grows in the middle from what it was before by that A times B term, right? So that electron density in between is what Lewis was talking about, holding the things together, although it's only a 20th of a Lewis, typically, for a normal bond. Okay, so that's bonding. And by the same token, we saw this before, that kind of thing, where you shrink the electron density over what it would be had it been just two atoms, is, of course, antibonding. Okay, so let's look at that overlap term again. So here's psi A squared, so the wave function of that atom, that's its probability density. Okay, now where is psi A squared significant? Is it significant there? Significant magnitude? No, obviously not. Okay, is it significant there? Yeah, it's somewhat. You know, not as significant as it is in the middle, but it's somewhat. So yeah, it's significant there. Is it significant there? A little bit, not very much. Okay, now, suppose you have two of these atoms, right? And now, we want to find where the product of those two wave functions is significant, this overlap term, the part that comes from squaring. Okay, where is that big? Is it big over there? No, because both A and B are really small there. Is it big here? Roy? Why not? Yeah, B is very small there. A is okay, but B is bad. Or small, that is to say. Okay, and how about there? Patrick?
Yes.
Why? Yeah, the product will maximize in halfway in between. They're both falling off exponentially, right? But halfway in between is where their product is the biggest. Okay, so that's the place we're interested in, right? So at the bond center, psi A equals psi B, right? The same distance from both of them. So the 2 times psi A psi B, that overlap term, is as large as psi A squared plus psi B squared. Now, psi A squared and psi B squared is what you got when you overlapped the two atoms without doing anything else to them. But now you've got certain density in the middle from that. But now you're adding twice that much in the middle because of this 2AB term. Adding that much again to double the amount of electron density over what it would have been if it had just been atoms. Okay, so that's a pretty big deal. So in this region in between where they both have significant values, you're going to build up electron density if you write the wave function that way. And this overlap integral, that is, how big is that product summed over all space, which will be mostly within that central region, right? That's going to measure how much net change you get when you go from the atom to this combination of the two atoms. Sum that product up over every place. Now let's look at how this works for the simplest molecule, H2. Actually, this was reported in Israel Journal of Chemistry 40 years ago. And it's actually H2 molecule. So it's two electrons, but they both have the same wave function, right? The lowest energy wave function. Okay, they have different spins, as you probably have heard, which is what allows them to have the same spatial wave function. Okay, so we know exactly what the wave function psi A and psi B for 1s of hydrogen are. They're just a decaying exponential, sometimes some constant. So that is, those two-way functions look like that. And they overlap. They have simultaneous values at the same point in space in this region in the middle here. Okay, now, if you then look in a two-dimensional contour plot at the electron density near the protons, what you see is what you expect. It's mostly on the protons, most of the electron density, and it falls off and so on. And this is the total electron density. But what we really want to see is what's bonding, what's changing from just being two atoms. And what do you do for that purpose? To see the change. How do you see the change from just having atoms if you know the total? Okay. You're so shy. You subtract out the atoms, right? And that's what this is. This is the difference density. So this is how the electron density shifted, right? Now this one is contoured at a fairly high density, 0.025, relative to this one, 0.005. So these lines aren't nearly as significant as those lines. It's very little shift in electron density. Okay, but anyhow, you see that there's a buildup to a density of by an amount of 0.02 electrons per cubic AU, the atomic unit, the Bohr radius, at that position, right? And this wave function, just adding this to this, 1 over the square root of 2, or a little less than 1 over the square root of 2 times that, the simplest possible wave function you could imagine, right, already gets the total electronic energy correct within 92.9%. That is, it only lacks 7.1% of having the true energy for that molecule. Now, but almost all of that energy was already there in the atoms. The change on making the bond, you're not nearly as accurate on, because the change is a difference between pretty big numbers. So this overstates how good that is. In fact, it only accounts for 50% of the bond energy of the change in coming together. But still, that's not bad for the simplest possible thing. Just add the two atoms together, and the two wave functions together, and you get half of the total bond energy, okay, as your estimate. Now, notice high accuracy is required to calculate a correct value of the bond energy, because it's the difference between big numbers. And that's the same reason that in X-ray, if you wanted to get significant difference densities, you had to have very good experimental density to do the subtracting. If it was crummy, then you just get nonsense. Right? Okay, so the very crudest model already shows most, that is, more than 50% of the bond. Okay, and notice what it did. It shifted electron density from the atom to the space in between. Okay? But not much density, just a little bit. Now, this is not a solution to the Schrödinger equation. If you use this wave function and go to different places that there are different potential energies, but they're not made up by the change in curvature, because this is not the true wave function. But you could make the wave function better. And a criterion for making it, how do you know what's better when you change the shape of the wave function? You calculate, not if you have a true wave function, then no matter where you calculate the kinetic energy, the curvature, right, and the potential energy, they'll always add up to the same thing, the total energy. If you don't have a correct wave function, then you'll get different values for the total energy at different places. But if you look at the average energy over all the different places, then as that gets lower, you can prove that the wave function is getting closer to the true wave function. That makes sense, right? But it happens to be provable, but not by us. Okay, so you adjust the orbital shape in order to lower the average total energy, right, what you would calculate for kinetic plus potential energy with that wave function. And that makes psi more realistic, because the true energy turns out to be the lowest possible energy. And that there's the name of that is the variational principle, but we're just going to mention it now and not again. It's just that there's a method that allows you to improve a wave function, which is change the shape and see whether the average energy is better. Okay, now how could we change the shape? Well, one thing we might do is these shapes are these exponentials, right? So one way to change the shape is to change how rapidly the exponentials fall away. You could use, instead of this, you could have one that doesn't fall, that falls away faster, or one that's spread out and falls away slower. Right? So we could change that exponent. That is, what is that factor? It's 2 here that we used, but we could use a different factor. Now, so all you can do then is just change that, calculate the average energy, which is laborious, but you do it, right? Then change it again, change it again, change it again, until you get the lowest possible. Okay? So they did that, right? And it turned out that if you spread it out, then you get lower energy. Can you see what spreading it, why spreading it out might help? Look in here as compared to here. You get more overlap, right, when they spread out. Okay? So, indeed, the best value turned out to have 2.4 rather than 2 here, right? And when they did that, they got this difference density, which looks more or less like the first one, except that it increases the density in here. See, there are more contours. So it doubles the amount of electron density that's shifted from the near the nucleus to in the bonding region, right? And now you get 73% of the total bond energy, right? So you went from lacking 50% to lacking only about 25%. So it more or less doubled the accuracy of the energy by doing that. But it's still not a true solution of the wave function. You get different values of the energy. It's just the average energy that got lowered. Okay, so a more realistic way to deform the atomic orbital we've already looked at, more realistic than this. Okay, and this is, I'll remind you of it. Here's a 1s orbital. And suppose we wanted to deform it by putting a charge nearby, which you'll notice is what actually we're doing. We're bringing another nucleus up. Okay? What did we do before to change the shape of a wave function when we had a charge? Yeah. Yeah, that is, that the bringing the charge up applies an electric field. But how do we change, what do we do to change the wave function? What? Add what? What would you add to S in order to make it shift in this direction of the positive charge? Yeet?
Add a p orbital,
right? Which reinforces on this side, tends to cancel the numbers on this side, and shifts it. Now I'm going to do that, but you have to watch closely because it's subtle. So here's the 100% 1s, and there is the best value if you're trying to calculate a hydrogen molecule, right? What it did was put in 3% roughly of 2p to shift it to the right, and a little bit, 0.06% of 2s, which allowed it to expand a little bit. Right? So you expand it a little bit and shift it a little bit to the right. And then if you use that as your atomic orbital, so change its shape in that way, rather than doing this thing of just crudely flattening it out, you get a directed shift. It shifts in the right direction. See, when you flattened it out, you shifted it in the wrong direction as well as the right direction. This shifts it all in the right direction. Okay, so it looks like that now when you do this. And there's the difference density. Now that looks rather different, right? So because hybridization was directed toward the center of the bond, one atom shifted this way, the other atom shifted that way toward the center, now you get it, 3 times as much shift of electron density. It now builds up to 0.11 instead of 0.04 in the middle. But even more important than that, look where it shifts from, right? Here it was coming away from the nucleus mostly to go into the middle. But now it's coming from this region out here into the middle. So the electrons are not getting further away from the nucleus. They're just shifting from this side of the nucleus to this side of the nucleus, where they happen to be near the other nucleus as well. So that's a great deal. Right? So that's now, but notice it didn't do much change of the bond energy. It only improved it by 3%. Right? It still lacks 24% of 100% of the bond energy. So it looks very good, but why do you think, what's really intrinsically wrong with this way of calculating things with molecular orbitals. The fact that we're doing a hydrogen molecule, not a H2 plus ion, what have we forgotten? Well, let's look here. So the next improvement, so that energy change is small, but the distribution change is really promising. Now, we've gotten to this stage, and what we do is do what's called a configuration interaction calculation. For what purpose? To allow the electrons to keep away from one another. Now you notice this is the new electron density. Now we get to 90% of the bond energy, right? Much better than it was before, twice as close to 100% as 75% was. Okay, but the density change isn't very small. So how could we make the density, the total density, not change, but the energy got so much better, right? How can you do that? What did this new wave function, a much more complicated wave function, allow? What's the correction that it made? For what phenomenon? What kind of energy? Correlation energy, right? Although the total density is the same, at any given instant, this more complicated wave function allows one electron never to be really near the other one. It keeps them apart from one another within keeping the total constant, right? So it makes very little difference in the overall energy, but if they had gone all the way to the true wave function, then this would have been 100%, right? But this simple thing that was done 40 years ago already got them that close. Okay, but an important lesson here is that correlation doesn't do much to change the electron distribution, the total electron density. What it changes is this instantaneous distance between the electrons. Okay, so this is now a really good wave function for qualitative purposes. You take adjust this AO maybe, right, in hybridization and so on, but 1 over the square root of 2 or a little less than 1 over the square root of 2 is a really good square root of the wave function. Okay, now its virtues are that it's easy to formulate, easy to understand, that you just add two orbitals together, that it looks like the atoms, especially when you're really near the nucleus. You have just the right curvature and so on. And that's the main event for electron energy. The energies of the atoms are much, much bigger than the energies change when you make bonds. It builds up electron density between the nuclei through this overlap, the two wave functions having values in the same region of space between them. That's the source of bonding. And it also smooths psi to lower the kinetic energy. We've seen that before. Hybridizing the atomic orbitals provides flexibility. That is, you still keep the right shape when you're in the region of the nuclei, but by doing this hybridization, you can shift the wave function in the direction you wanted to. And in fact, with the set of all possible atomic orbitals, if you hybridize, you can get any shape you want. But you have to use, you know, like the 15Z orbital to get really weird shapes. But for the things we're interested in, just the S and P orbitals usually do it, the 2S and 2P. Okay, so we'll keep it simple. A simple LCAOMO wave function, and only use the valence shell, that is 2s and 2p for carbon and oxygen and so on. So that's really great. So we square it, you get this. That's the atoms. And then this is the bond, the overlap part. Okay? Now notice that we had to have less than 1 over the square root of 2 to have this normalized because of this thing. But another linear combination we could have used would have a minus sign there, right? But if we use the minus sign there, changes the sign there, and therefore makes this greater than 1 over the square root of 2, rather than less. Okay, so you have the bond and the antibond. Okay, so bonding depends on how much overlap you get, and also on what we'll be talking about next lecture, energy match. So, but this lecture we're going to talk about overlap. So consider how the overlap integral is what you talk about, not just what the overlap is at this point or this point. The overlap is the product of A and B, the two wave functions on different atoms. Okay? So what we're really interested in is summing that overlap up of overall space, or integrating it. Okay? So that depends on how far apart the two atoms are. Obviously, when they're really far apart, there's no place that has a value for this, a significant value. And it also depends on hybridization, as we just saw for the H2 atom. And notice that in carbon, it's much easier to hybridize than in hydrogen. In hydrogen, we were mixing 1s with 2p. And to the extent we put 2p in, we gave it much higher curvature, much higher kinetic energy, right? So you don't want to mix much. If you're looking for the lowest possible energy, you don't want to have very much 2p together with the 1s. But in carbon, it's different because it's 2s mixing with 2p. Now you don't increase the curvature when you mix it, so it's much cheaper to do this mixing. So we're going to look at it with two carbon atoms. So here are two 2s orbitals of two carbon atoms. Okay. Now, we need a scale on this, and we can use the scale, but we know that the diameter of the node is 0.7 angstroms for carbon. Okay. So now we know the scale. We can shift the scale over here from the start at the middle, and if we put a little x on the end, that's 0.7 from each nucleus. And if we draw them together like that so the two x's superimpose, then their distance is 1.4 angstroms, which is very close to the carbon-carbon bond distance. So that's about what the two would look like. And obviously they're overlapping in this region. Okay? Now, the overlap, remember, is the product of A times B. So in this region you have blue overlapping with blue, positive with positive, or negative with negative, depending on what we call blue. Okay, so that's going to increase this integral. But also we're going to get red overlapping with the tail, this red overlapping with the tail end of this blue, and this red overlapping with that blue, and that'll be positive with negative, and that's going to decrease the total to the extent that that's important. Now, if we drew them together until they were exactly on top of one another, right, and then squared, what would the square be? It would be twice this. It would be using the same orbital twice if they started from the same place, right? So it'd be just squaring the orbital, and that square of an orbital is 1 normalized orbital. So how big do you think this overlap integral is? Guess how big the overlap integral is. That's the sum up of all the different A times B's over all points in space. Some places it's positive. Some places it's negative. Some places out here it's essentially 0. Right? And remember that if you had them exactly on top of one another, so the red reinforced red and blue reinforced blue, then it would sum up to 1. I'm interested because my intuition seems to be different from that of a lot of people. How big do you think the integral should be? Let me start with, the maximum it could ever be if they were right on top of one another is 1. And here there are going to be places where the opposite sign comes in, as well as many places where it's going to be 0. So let me just start. How many think it'll be still 1? 0.9, 0.8, 0.7, 0.6, 0.5. 0.4, 0.3, 0.2, 0.1, less than 0.1. I would have guessed about maybe 0.2 or 0.1, something like that, because they're so far from being right on top of one another, and there's cancellation in many regions. But in fact, the value is 0.41, so your intuition was better than mine on this. So they overlap at the bonding distance, these 2s orbitals, about half as well as they would if they were right on top of one another. I think that's weird, but that's what the value is. Okay, but anyhow, so it varies obviously with respect to the distance. Now the range of the distance scale, so 0 is way out here someplace, right? here's one is here, 0.5, so twice that far back, but here's zero. But I'm showing only this range because that's the range we're interested in. Here's a carbon-carbon single bond, a carbon-carbon double bond, a carbon-carbon triple bond have those distances. So this is how much overlap these two S orbitals had when you put the X's on top of one another, and it was 1.4. But you can do this, you know, with your computer for all different distances, and that's what it looks like. As they get closer together, the overlap goes up. What does it go to if we continue this graph all the way out to zero? What would the value be at zero? It would be one, right? It would be just squaring the orbital. Okay, so at zero it would go up to one. Okay, now let's look at different orbitals and how they overlap. Suppose we have an S overlapping with a P orbital. Right? How much overlap interval, if you sum up the overlap everywhere, can you see what you would get? Remember what the overlap is? It's the product of the two numbers, the number that this wave function assigns, the product of that, and the wave that that one assigns. So, incidentally, notice that pi, as we say, the Greek letter, in fact, in Greek, you pronounce it p. It's the Greek equivalent of p. And if you're Greek, you see that symbol, you say p, not pi. Okay, but it's a name for a molecular orbital, which is analogous, and the reason is that it's analogous to a p atomic orbital, which has a nodal plane through the nucleus. So this p orbital here, the 2p, has a nodal plane that goes there. And if you have a pi molecular orbital, it has a nodal plane that goes through the nuclei. But you'll notice this one has that nodal plane, but this one doesn't. Right? So down below, this product is plus with plus. But up above, it's plus with minus because it's red. But it's symmetrical. It's the same value. What's the total going to be? Zero. So there's not going to be any overlap between those because of their different symmetries. So they're said in that case to be orthogonal. That means they have a net overlap of zero. Not just because they're far apart, but because you have this balancing. They're orthogonal. Okay, so forget that. You're never going to get any overlap, any bonding from a p orbital, a pi orbital interacting with s. Can you see a way in which you might be able to get overlap between p and s? Yeah, turn it, Aisha says. Okay, so if we turn the p orbital like that and now bring it together, you're going to get blue with blue before you get red with blue. So as you start out at the right and you have sp sigma, the sigma is the Greek s. So this one doesn't have a plane that goes through the two nuclei, right? Then it looks like that. Well, incidentally, what does that one go when you get all the way to zero? If you brought this one to be so their center was on top of this one, can you see what it would be, the overlap? Carl? Okay, so this is a function. It's got negative numbers here, positive numbers here, and negative numbers here, let's say. And we're looking at the product of the number that this gives, different regions are positive, with what this one gives. Okay. Now we're going to make their centers the same. We're going to move this center right to there. Now, so we have on the left here, we're going to have, say, blue with blue out here. But on the right, we're going to have red with blue. Zero. They're orthogonal when it goes to, so when you go all the way down to zero distance, that one's going to go to zero. Okay. Now, we could, of course, have two p orbitals interacting with one another. And it could be sigma, that is, there isn't a node that contains both nuclei. Right? Then if we start drawing them together, we're going to get overlap. Right? And it looks like that. And what will that go to when the distance becomes zero? Megan? No. So put this one on top of this one. What kind of numbers do you get on the left? Red times blue. Negative. What kind of numbers do you get on the right?
Negative.
What's it going to go to? But how big?
Negative.
Minus one. It's just like squaring it, except you got a minus sign everywhere. So that one will go way down to minus one when you get to d equals zero. Okay, so that's not as effective at these distances. You can see, you can infer from this that maybe at a longer distance it might be a little bit favorable, more favorable than the others. Okay, and this then is two p orbitals coming together sideways, pi overlap, and that's this one here. So not quite as good. Well, it depends on the distance, whether sigma or pi of the p's is better. Okay. Now, there's something here that I think is curious, which is you might think that s orbitals are better overlapping than p orbitals, or you might think that p orbitals are better to overlap than s. But the curious thing is that the best is s overlapping with p. That's the purple one here, right? It's better than either s with s or p with p. I think that's funny. It turns out to be significant, though, as you'll see here. Now, suppose we make a hybrid orbital, sp cubed. What do you think about this one as we bring it together so that they get close enough? Do you think you're going to get more overlap or less than you got before? As you start bringing them together, you're going to get big blue numbers overlapping with big blue numbers, right? That's much better than anything we had before. They're directed, right? So there's the curve for that. It's better than any of the pure orbitals interacting, right? And now suppose we did sp squared with sp squared. Do you remember when we looked at hybridization, how the changes shifted? What happened as we put, as we went toward 50-50? Remember, it shifted more and more and more in one direction. So not, you won't be surprised then that you get better overlap with sp squared than you do with sp cubed. Or suppose you go to sp, right? Then you have that. Now, you can go beyond sp. You could have s squared p, right? Two-thirds s and one-third p. Is that going to be better still? Do you remember what happened when we put an electric field on to shift the electron density by hybridization? What happened? It was maximum at sp, right? And then it starts coming back again. Right? So, in fact, S squared P is about the same in overlapping in this region, although it gets smaller out there. But it's not much improvement. You don't get anything by doing that. And you lose, in fact, and as I'll explain shortly. But look at this. The pure orbitals overlap in the lower one. The hybrid orbitals are at the top. So hybrids overlap about twice as well as pure orbitals. So they're much better for bonding, for shifting those electrons in between. Because they allow a nearly full measure of S overlapping with P, as well as S with S and P with P, because both of the orbitals have both S and P in them. That seems a little cryptic. It takes a while to think through it, so don't hurt your head with that one. But notice that SP gives the best overlap, except in some regions it would be S squared P. But you can only have two orbitals of that sort because each of them has 50... SP means 50% S, 50% P, right? Once you've made two of them, you've used up all the S, right? That you have 300% of P to use because you have three P orbitals, but you only have one S. 1, 2s orbital. So once you've made two of these, you've shot your bolt, and after that, you have to use P with P, which is very weak at overlapping. Right? So by far the best thing is, far better, is to use four sp cubes. Each of those has only 25% of the s in it. Right? So you can get four of these instead of just two of those. So you get overall much better. So that's why sp3 is such a popular hybridization. We're going to get into next lecture, as I said, into the other criterion for this bond forming stuff. What we've been talking about here is overlap and how by changing hybridization you could improve overlap. And when you have overlap, you build up the electron density between the nuclei, which constitutes a bond. Okay, that's what we've been looking for, what a bond is. Okay, but now how effective that is depends on several things. Obviously, how good the overlap is, but it also depends on whether the two atoms that are coming together have the same energy. And you'll not be surprised to hear this has to do with polar bonds and stuff like that. Okay, we're going to get into that next lecture. But first, let's just review something like that. Something that we've seen before, that look at this in the context of a double minimum. In the first case, where the energy match is perfect, where the two orbitals have the same energy, two atoms are the same, like H2 or O2 or N2 or 2z. So we saw this kind of thing before. It was hard to draw with true Coulombic potentials, but we can get the idea of a double minimum here. And we saw that if the total energy is like that, you get a wave function that looks like that, but also a wave function that looks like that. But they have essentially the same energy, the same curvature. Because they have so little overlap, they don't influence one another. Right? And we did this exactly this before, so you're familiar with it. Okay, but if you draw the two together, you increase the overlap of the function that's in one and the function that's in the other minimum. So as you draw it together, you get something that looks like that for the favorable one, which, notice, hasn't changed the energy significantly yet. And that one, right? If you make it even more, you get much more overlap. And now you begin to get a splitting, a difference in the favorable and the unfavorable energy. And if you draw them still closer together like this, you get the favorable, which has fallen down still further, and the unfavorable, and which has risen still higher. So you have still a bigger splitting. So overlap, the overlap as you bring them together is what causes this splitting, where you have this special doubling in the middle, right, of the electron density. So the overlap holds atoms together. So just to rehearse that, you have A and B. If they're far apart, they have those energies. But if you bring them close together, you get this wave function 1 over the square root of 2, positive, which is bonding, negative, which is antibonding, and you get a splitting like that. Now, remember that one of them should be a little less than 1 over the square root of 2. The other's a little bit greater. And if you normalize that over because of the overlap, right? So you use the greater than here and less than here. You're not surprised to hear that this is bigger than this, because this is the greater than 1 over the square root of 2. This is the less than. So this builds up electron density in the middle, right? But this depletes electron density in the middle. But this one depletes density more than this one builds it up, because of the less than and greater than thing. So the two don't go up and down exactly the same distance. The one that goes up a little more than the one that goes down. Now, let's look, and then if you have still more overlap, it's the same deal, even more so about up and down. Now, let's look at how the number of electrons there are in the molecule influences the strength of the bond. Suppose you have just one electron on one of the atoms. You bring them together so that the energy is split and the electron goes down in energy, and that obviously is favorable, right? So that forms a bond if you have just one electron. Now suppose you have two electrons. Now what? Is that bonding? How does it compare with having just one electron? It's twice as good as having one electron. Okay, almost. There's electron-electron repulsion that you have to take into account. So that one's strongly bonding. Now suppose there were three electrons that were involved. Then what? You can only put two electrons in this orbital with different spins, right? But if you have a third electron, then that one goes up. And what now? How strong is that bond going to be? Is it as strong as this one? No. Because we have a negative. Is it as strong as this one? Why not? Because this one went up more than this one went down. Right? So it's weakly bonding if you have three. And how about if you have four? Now it's bad, right? Because these two go up in energy. So this is the energies when they're far apart. This is the energies when they're together. The energy is higher together than when they're apart, because those two went up more than the other two went down. So that one is antibonding. So that's why helium atoms don't form a normal bond, right? Because there are four electrons in the 1s orbitals when they come together. And the repulsion is bigger than the attraction because of this normalizing factor. Okay? So that's where we wanted to get to today.